and well, we will be having a lot of sharing in this session. And so I think Lisa's gonna, I don't think we've introduced, this is Lisa Dalton. She's our host, helping to host today. Dear friend from the Central Region.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I will be muting you all, including you, Hazel, and then I'll unmute you. And we are recording.
Beautiful. Okay. I still hear some little crunchy, some people crunching or something in here, having their lunch. All right. So we are officially starting. Oops.
Sorry, Hazel. I'm just, it's taking a moment to get, okay. We should be good.
Very good. Well, official welcome, dear friends. And yesterday we gathered. It was Orthodox Holy Saturday. We dug deep. We went into the inner layers of the earth to see the treasures and the challenges there. And today, oh my goodness, I keep changing the slide here. That's not what we want to do. I'm just going to stop that for now. I want to welcome you because it's Orthodox Easter. So whatever tradition you celebrate, I hope that we can continue this Easter mood for our gathering today. And you know, I think pretty much all of us were here yesterday. If you weren't, you could just be here in this moment. That's fine. But I just wanted to check in and see how night school was. Was everybody in class? Did they bring their pen and their paper, and did they take notes? And yeah, night school. We were always there, and I hope that we paid special attention to the lessons. And, we did. We covered a lot of material yesterday. If you're like me, impressions from the night are often very instructive. So I would like to just start off right away with a check-in and invite everybody to just share a little bit of, whatever's going on with you, if any thoughts came from the night. Or other parts of the conference, or, just to sort of warm the space together and feel that we're all here celebrating this continuing Easter mood. So if you want to share, just unmute yourself and let's let the party begin.
I noticed that Timothy made a comment in the chat. And so maybe Timothy might like to share a little bit more.
Timothy. Sorry for the challenge in unmuting. I think we were both trying to unmute me at the same time. And I guess my comment was just gratitude for Patrick taking the time to really stay simple and universal with his presentation so that it can be a tool for sharing and beginning proactive grieving in our communities around us in the preparation for the process of knowing that birth into the spiritual world in a new way. And that was a part of my night last night. And I've been really connecting with our mutual grandfather that we never knew. He died in 57. But he's been really coming back strong and been entering into a renewed dialogue. Just found out he was born in Portland, Oregon. Never knew any of my family lived in Portland, Oregon before. So.
Wow.
New futures unfolding with the past.
Exactly. And we will actually be talking about this intermingling of past, present, and future in a few minutes. So that's perfect. Anyone else have anything to share, perhaps from our session yesterday, or thoughts from the night?
And Judith, did you want to say anything? Because your hand is still up. You're on. Okay, so we lost her, so. Anyone else? Sue, I'll unmute you, Sue. Here you are.
Oh, thank you. I have been, well, very inspired by the idea that of me, you asking those on the other side to help us with the epidemic. And I was left with the question, you know, I've been working with people that I know who are on the other side. And yet I had this bigger concept that maybe more are available to us, or are people working with all of the dead. And I can make those general prayers, but without a personal connection. So anyway, I was living with that question. And this morning I woke up with a visitation from a member of our community who died at least 10, maybe 15 years ago. And she wasn't a close friend, but I was a part of her community care team. And it's just, oh, I have a new friend and guide on the other side. And her presence is very, very different from my friends and family who have died in the past 5 years. And it's very exciting and feels like new horizons, new hope, new visions, new deepened relationship. So thank you. Thank you all, the whole conference, for bringing this all together.
Great. Judith, I think you're up now.
Am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
Okay. But I just spoke a few minutes ago. I guess that was muted.
It was.
Okay.
Would you mind re-sharing, please?
I'm confused. Well, it's been a wonderful experience to be here for 3 days, and I'm looking very forward to Hazel's talk today and Raven's eurythmy. And I can't say enough for the fact that we are lucky to have this kind of technology that we can be in Montana and see everybody and visit and hear these explanations and these journeys that you're taking us on. Thank you.
Anyone else? Hazel. You are unmuted, Hazel.
Thank you. Very good. Okay, you know what? I feel like we need to get up and move a little bit. I feel like there's a little bit of a stuckness going on here. Maybe we need to acknowledge, like we did yesterday, that you know, we're getting on the tractor. So we're going to say, work, Araman, work. And we are using this technology for our spiritual means. And so, yeah, we see you, and we're grateful, and we're using this for our spirit. So I'm going to ask Raven to come in and do some eurythmy with us before we really open up this sacred gateway for ourselves this afternoon. Raven, are you there? Oh my gosh.
I'm unmuting her. Hey,
thank you. Now I'm unmuted. Thank you so much, Hazel. I was feeling the same thing. One of the things that I find when I'm on the screen too much and sitting so much, listening, as wonderful as it is I get cold. And I think that's one of the dangers of technology that we can really do something about. There's two things I want to share. One from my night school. Just as I was falling asleep, I had such an image of my heart being a window and that I could open the curtains and through it, I can see you and I can see your window and that I know that through me, you can also see and that helps me to see myself. The verse that we started with Eurythmy yesterday about the sun, I think will really warm us. Because when we think of the strength of the sun, it is the warmth and the light. And when, like a plant, when we can take that in, then we can share our warmth with the world. So my hope is that we will do this and that we will feel heart warmth and even physical warmth. I hope you'll be able to see me. Somebody will need to let me know if I'm not invisible.
You look great. We see you perfectly. Thank you.
Thank you. So just, it's great if you can stand, and if you can't, really, you just need to tune into your own heart. And then welcome the sun. Into my heart streams the strength of the sun. Into my soul weaves the warmth of the world. I will to breathe the power of the sun. I will to feel the warmth of the world. Power of the sun pours into me. Strength of warmth of the world permeates me. We'll do it again. I'm going to move a little. I hope it's not disturbing visually. Into my heart streams the power of the sun. Into my soul weaves the warmth of the world. I will to breathe the power of the sun. I will to feel the warmth of the world. Power of the sun pours into me. Warmth of the world permeates me. We're going to be doing some more Eurythmy a little bit later, and I look forward to sharing with you.
Hazel, you're on.
Great. So thank you. Thank you very much, Raven. That's just what I needed. Perfect. So I just really relate to this idea of the imagination of the sacred gateway as this swinging door. You know, this portal that brings the concepts of past, present, and future into this interweaving. So seasonally speaking, we plant, right? And then we take stock of what we've reaped and sown. We got a wonderful illustration of that by Patrick. And this really gives us an opportunity to work with the messages that are coming from the foundation stone meditation to practice spirit recalling. And then when we're doing that, we're asking, yeah, we're looking at the past. We're saying, where did I come from? We're remembering the source from which we sprang and connecting also to our ancestors, to our grandfathers, to our grandmothers, those that came before us. And we can practice spirit sensing, really asking ourselves, hey, what did I come into this life to do? Where am I on this journey? And then we strive in our thinking to practice spirit beholding. Right? We're called to plan what seeds that we will germinate in the future. We can ask, yeah, where are we headed? What are my goals? And so as we stand at this sacred gateway, this swinging door, we can ask questions like, who have I been? Not just in this life, but in other lives. As we stand in this moment, we say, who am I now? And we can ask ourselves, who do we want to become? And of course, these are the perfect kind of questions that we can bring to our dearly departed and to the unborn, those wanting to come into incarnation. We need to ask them questions as well. What do you need for your future when you come through the gate? And perhaps during this time between the resurrection and the ascension, we can make a point to really ask these kinds of questions in connection with those on the other side. So I always like to be where we are right now. And I just want to say, okay, let's orient ourselves here on the wheel of the year. And so if we look across that circle from where we are, we see that Michaelmas is the counterpart to Easter. So in the fall, when all of nature appears to die, it's then that we have to call up in ourselves what the Eastertide represents. Right? When everything's withering and dying, we have to remember in our souls what it was like now when things are bursting forth and full of life. We have to remember the truth of resurrection, the fact that Christ, as victor over death, brings us the possibility of reincarnation, of rebirth. So in the fall, in the dying time, in the time of Michaelmas, we must turn our heart thinking inward, a kind of spiritual digestion, to recall the springtime resurrection as we face death in the cycle of the year in full consciousness, to look out into that withering world of nature with the intention of releasing the elemental beings from the dying plant, to redeem them by our heart thinking, infused with this Easter mood. So in addition to the Easter festival, which brings alive this reality of first death, then the resurrection, humanity needs this Michaelmas festival so that we can find in the round of the seasons the necessity of achieving first a resurrection of the soul, and then a conscious entering into dying, a conscious entering into dying, in order that we as human beings may cross the threshold in a conscious way. Does that make sense? So what do I mean by a resurrection of the soul? Well, our soul is made up of forces of thinking, feeling, and willing. So at Michaelmas, it seems like a perfect opportunity to renew, to resurrect those forces within ourselves, to activate our imagination, our inspiration, our intuition. And so, friends, the true purpose of the time of dying is to consciously prepare for death. We can do that in the seasonal round at Michaelmas. We're so lucky that we have these seasons. They give us these opportunities, right? Can you feel it now, this Easter mood that we're in? You know, we're practicing for our own initiation across the threshold. And while we're here to work with our dearly departed, which is not only a source of individual consultation, it's more than that, as Patrick was saying, right? It provides a nourishment that all of civilization needs, not just our beloved dead, but all of all society, in order that we could still really steer toward a healthy future. So this effort is really part of a greater work of overcoming materialism and spiritualizing human life on Earth. We have to live knowing that death is part of life. Since this work is an aspect of cosmic evolution as a whole, it really does involve the entire spiritual world, right? All those seven planetary layers, all those beings that are represented there. And then when we get out into the circle of the zodiac, all of those beings are working down into the earth with us now. And those that are across the threshold are working with those spirits as well. So we're not alone. We're not isolated. We're always, the room is full. Can you feel? Just open your consciousness to the fact that we have allies forever with us. So I thought maybe we could take a couple questions if there is any. I don't have my chat open. I don't know if anybody's doing anything on that. There we go. But I also thought it'd be nice to just do a little spirit recalling, to look back at the past, at the origins of this human urge to honor and celebrate those on the other side, seen in the many cultures around the world. So did anyone have anything they want to add before we take that journey? You know, we really, really can learn so much from the myths and the legends around this ultimate initiation called death. It, you know, it really is a true rite of passage. So, I mean, you don't even have enough room on a screen to put in all the many cultural expressions, because every culture has a way of honoring the dead. And we can, when we start to look at these things, we can see that there's a lot of similarities in the rituals and in the ceremonies and such that people have. And so here's just a little sampling of a few things. And then I want to really go into more detailed examples to show some really interesting contrasts. It's nice to see the similarities, but it's also interesting to look at things that are very different. So after we do a little bit of that, I would really like to invite you to share your tradition. And perhaps you don't really have one, and maybe some of what we talk about here will help to inspire you to create one for yourself and your family. So I really love to go back to ancient Persia, Mesopotamia, Sumeria, and see there our connection with the spiritual world and how it's shown in myths and legends like the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example, which is a beautiful myth, and we could just do a whole lecture on that, which would be quite an interesting way to look at this subject. But really this longing to try to understand what death is, feeling ourselves as immortal beings and having to deal with that threshold. So go back and read that. It's really quite beautiful. And in ancient Egypt, right, we find a powerful funeral text illustrated with vignettes depicting the dead in their journey in the afterlife. And it's commonly called the Book of the Dead. But it actually translates to mean Book of Coming Forth by Day, or Book of Emerging Forth into the Light, right? So that's a kind of an interesting way of thinking about it, right? This birth into the spiritual world. They really got that that aspect. And this text consists of a number of what we might call magic spells intended to assist the journey of the human soul through the duat. That's their word for the underworld, and this journey into the afterlife. So it was actually written by many, many priests over a period of 1,000 years. And so it was placed in the coffin or the burial chamber, along with all the other important items that they might need in the life between death and rebirth. So a lot there to be talked about in ancient Egypt. And this one that I discovered that I hadn't heard of before, you know, many cultures have a myth about the great flood, right, the deluge. And there's this ancient Egyptian Vag festival, which is a ritualistic remembrance of this. And it's a three-day festival. And the first night depicts the wickedness of the world before the deluge. And the second night acknowledges the few that survived the flood. The second or the third night celebrates those who would come back to repopulate the earth. So we see this how do we deal with change on a big level? And this idea that we will come again. And, you know, I just want to touch in, you know, again, a whole subject here, this epoch of the Egyptian era. But we can see, I put a little chart down in the bottom of this slide here where we can, you know, if you do any biography work, you see that U, and you can put the different 7-year changes across, and you can see how they work together and sort of have this recapitulation on a higher level. And so Anthroposophy talks about how the third cultural epoch, the Egyptian time, we're sort of recapitulating that now. And so when we think about what does that really mean, we take up a lot of the attributes, a lot of the ritual type things that happened then in a modern sort of way. But it's always not quite right because we've changed and our consciousness has evolved. We're in the consciousness soul age now. And so things that might have worked for them then might not be in the right place for us now. And one of those things was embalming. So we know how in ancient Egypt that was a very big part of their ritual funeral services. And it really wasn't part of our lives in the modern age at all. People had home funerals. That was what was natural. Until the Civil War. And that's when it really started. It became this big business. Because of course, you know, families wanted to be able to honor their loved ones. And when they died out in the field, how would they be able to receive the body unless they did this particular, performed this act? So that somehow became very, very popular and became something that everybody thought was the only way to do things and sort of taken over the modern way of thinking. But of course, we know that there are many alternatives and green burial being one of them that we'll talk about later. But interesting to see how we take up certain things that aren't quite right, and we don't really realize where they come from. So we moving on through the epochs here, we're gonna land for a minute here in ancient Greece, where we have the wonderful story of Demeter and Persephone. Again, we see this parallel between spring and autumn. And Persephone, as a goddess of spring, was worshipped alongside her mother Demeter in the Eleusinian mysteries. So these agricultural-based school really promised the initiate a sanctified passage through the afterlife. And these mysteries also really worked with Persephone as the queen of the underworld. But as the goddess of spring, her title was Kore, which means the maiden. And her story is a tale of initiation, not abduction. So we can really, if we put it in that light, it really does show us those mysteries of death. And her annual return to the earth in the spring, really very much a prefiguring of the resurrection of Christ, marked in nature by the flowering of the meadows and the growth of the new grain. So her return to the underworld in autumn brings into focus the mysteries of death and dying, outpictured in the plant kingdom, like we talked about there with the modern festival of Michaelmas. So with these Eleusinian mysteries, we see elaborate initiation rites performed to gain inspiration and knowledge from the gods and the ancestors. So nowadays, in what Steiner calls the new mysteries, we don't call the gods down. We rise in our thinking to meet them. This is the reverse ritual, which is appropriate for our time. So the Romans, yeah, they had a similar festival of death and resurrection in honor of Circe, the goddess of grain. So anyone who had their oatmeal this morning, their cereal, their bowl of cereal, can thank the goddess of grain for that. And one of my favorites, in Scotland and Ireland, where the Druidic mystery schools had firm foundations, we see this triple goddess, the maiden representing rebirth, the mother nurturing new life, and the crone embodying wisdom and the transformation that the end of life brings, hold sway. So here in this tradition, death is seen as a celebration of life. You know, the Irish folk soul really knows that a death in the physical world is a birth in the spiritual world. So funerals are often festive occasions with storytelling and toasts and music. Anyone ever been to an Irish wake? It's a beautiful, beautiful experience. Yes. So most native peoples, people of the land, really have always practiced ancestor worship, including many Native American tribes. But I wanted to just speak a little bit about the ghost dance movement of the late 1800s, which influenced many communities, particularly the Sioux. And it was created in a time of genocide. So I think it was 1888, there's a story that the son of a medicine man became sick with a fever during the eclipse of the sun. So this created, you could say, an opening in his etheric body so that he was able to visit the spirit world and meet the supreme being. And he brought back what he learned, which he shared. One of the things was, yes, that all Native Americans should live honestly and shun the immoral ways of the white man, especially the consumption of alcohol. But what was interesting was that he called for prayer, meditation, singing, and dancing as an alternative to mourning the dead. That this is what the dead wanted. They didn't want to just have the lamenting. They wanted it to be a celebration of their crossing. So singing and dancing. And this ghost dance called in the ancestors from the other side in the hopes that they could help those tribes to safely drive the colonists out of their lands. So as was mentioned earlier, we did talk quite a bit about how the dead, those on the other side, can help us with issues and things in our current world. And so that's what they were doing, this ghost dance. That was their main reason for it. So in Africa, the spirits of the dead, they are known to watch over their living relatives and to intercede for them along with all kinds of other supreme spirits. So they often feed the dead along with these deities in elaborate ceremonies, creating a communion between the living and the spiritual world where the dead live. And of course, most of us are familiar with the well-known traditions from Mexico and Latin America, right? Has anyone ever seen these beautiful altars made for the Day of the Dead, 3-day festival? So yeah, they believe that the souls of the dead return to their families to be with them again at this time. So they make these beautiful ofrendas, these lovely altars where they give offerings of their favorite foods and drink and toys for the children, alcohol for the adults and marigolds and candles. And on November 2nd, families go to the cemeteries and decorate the graves and have a picnic. So now I thought I would just sort of delve deeper into the Hindu death rituals because they're very different. They follow a very unique pattern from the Vedas. And it's something that we don't often get to hear about. It seems a little foreign to us. And yet I think a lot of us can relate to the fact that they believe in reincarnation and these rites are very elaborate. So I thought I would just give a little window into that. I hope people find this interesting. That the rites were fulfilled by the whole family. Everybody participates, including the children. And when a person is nearing death, they bring them home. And they're laid in the room with their head facing east. A lamp is lit near their head. And the dying person is actually given a mantra, to concentrate on, something that will give them peace. And the kindred, they keep vigil until the great departure, praying, singing hymns, and reading scripture. They place like holy ash or sandalwood paste, and they put that on their forehead to cool them. Vedic verses are chanted and this beautiful ritual of putting a few drops of milk or holy water trickled into their mouth. So you could see they're really, really caring for them on a very spiritual level at this time, this really sacred moment before the gateway opens, right? Sort of keeping vigil there. And after death, the body's laid in the home's entryway with the head facing west. So now this is this idea that in the west, this is where they return now to the embrace of Mother Earth. They go out the western gate. And a lot of people, a lot of families, they build like a shelter where a fire ritual is performed. And they bless these 9 brass pots of water. One of them is clay and 9 brass pots of water. And usually the patriarch will lead these rites. And they perform this ritual where they pass this oil lamp that you see here in the picture over the remains. And they offer flowers. And the relatives, they carry the body to the back porch. They do this ritual cleansing. They remove the clothes. They put sesame oil on the head. The body is bathed with that water that was in those brass pots. And then they drape them with a white cloth. So they're wearing white, not black like we typically do. And then they are carried to a fire shelter. And here now the future generation comes to honor them. So the young children, holding incense sticks, they encircle the body, they sing hymns, and the women, they walk around the body and they offer these like little puffed rice nuggets. They give them these sort of a nourishment for the dead, for their journey ahead. And the widow takes her tali, which is a sort of a wedding pendant that she received at her wedding, and she takes it off and puts it around the husband's neck signifying their enduring connection together. I just find all this so, I love when people really express these things. I just think it's fascinating. And what's interesting is that it's only the men who then go to the cremation site, led by the chief mourner. And so there are two pots that are carried, a clay pot of water and another containing the embers from the home fire. So they bring the fire from their home to this ritual site. And then the body is taken three times around this pyre of wood and stuff that's been stacked up. And then after they walk around three times, they place the body there. And then they offer the puffed rice, as the women did. And then they cover the body with wood and offer incense and ghee. And then with the clay pot on his left shoulder, the chief mourner, like, he circles around the pyre, holding a firebrand behind his back. And at each turn, a relative knocks a hole in the pot with a knife. And this lets some water out, which represents the soul leaving its vessel, right? So they're really honoring this slow leaving of the being that was in this human vessel. And so they do this, they take three turns around, and then the chief mourner drops the pot and it shatters. And then without turning to face the body, he lights the pyre and leaves the cremation grounds. So then it doesn't end there. They all return home and they all bathe and share, and they clean up the house. And then they take a lamp and they set it with a water pot where the body had laid in state. And then this water is changed daily, and you know, they turn the pictures to the wall or they cover them up, and the shrine room is closed with a white cloth, you know, draping all the icons. So these are days of what they call ritual impurity. So the family and relatives, they don't go out, but neighbors come over and they bring the meals. And then after 12 hours after the cremation, the men then return to collect the remains. And the water is sprinkled on the ash. And the remains are collected in this large tray and then placed in an urn, or they scatter it in a body of water, which you can see here in this image of the Ganges. Yeah, that's kind of famous. So then on the third day, the relatives, they get together for a meal with their favorite foods for their beloved. That's kind of a common thing to feed the dead in that way. But then they take the remains and they offer it up at an abandoned place for the homeless, which I thought was interesting. So these rituals are performed, but it's important to remember that they don't want to linger too long on these things, because they feel like that would hinder their progress in the spiritual world. So they don't prolong grieving. It's very much discouraged. They feel that would hold the dead in earthly consciousness, inhibiting their full transition into the spiritual world. So I just thought that would be a nice little in-depth. We don't always get to hear about these other cultures. But many people have heard of the Chinese and many Buddhists who celebrate. They also believe in reincarnation, and they conduct these two-week hungry ghost festivals. And we touched on this a little bit yesterday, this idea of the hungry ghost. And this idea that those who were not able to bring spiritual thoughts in their life on earth, that they sort of become bound to the earth and can be used by adversarial beings as forces of destruction and disease. So they work with them. You know, they acknowledge that this could happen, and they create ceremonies so that they can feed these hungry ghosts and let them know that they are spiritual beings, and they offer them light. Because again, when you're in the darkness, light is what feeds you. So they make these lotus flowers and they carry them out into the street at dusk. And the Japanese, they have a similar festival for the dead, although they put the lanterns in water and let them flow forth. Now, I found it interesting that the Catholic Church took over an ancient Roman Day of the Dead, which was Feralia. It used to be in February, and they transferred it to the 1st of November. You know, that's kind of a famous thing. You build a church on top of where a temple was or a sacred shrine. So sort of taking over the ancient Days of the Dead, something the Catholic Church did. And then this idea of the Jewish tradition, which I think shows another contrast, very, very different from the Eastern rites. And so it's interesting because the funerals are usually held in a synagogue or a funeral home or at the gravesite right away, 24 hours after death. And there is no visitation, no open casket or a cremation, not an option. And the service is usually conducted by a rabbi who reads the eulogy. So a little bit removed there. It's not so much the family, it's an outside authority. And but they have this really interesting ceremony you often see where they cut this black ribbon to symbolize the individual breaking away from loved ones. And then they hold what they call a minyan. This is at least 10 Jewish adults, usually men, who recite the Kaddish, the prayers. And at the cemetery, this is where the family gets to participate a little bit. They get to place, everybody's invited to come up and place three shovelfuls of dirt on the coffin before it's buried. And this symbolizes their acceptance of the finality of death. So Jewish funerals are often held at the graveside. But it's interesting because flowers are not appropriate, really. You don't see very many flowers. Maybe it's too pagan, I'm not sure. But instead you make a donation to a charity. That's appreciated. And they don't have a tombstone right away. It's always on the first anniversary that the tombstone is put in. And when folks go to visit the grave, it's the custom for the mourners to place a pebble or stones on top of the tombstone. Has anyone ever seen that in a grave cemetery? You see the stones on top. And I never knew this before, but it's a belief that has roots in the Talmud, which is a sacred book, that souls, they believe that souls continue to dwell by their graves. Yeah, I mean, that's why we hold the three-day vigil. And so this ancient rationale for the stones is that they keep the soul from haunting the living. So the stones are not only a marker of one's visit, they are a means by which the living help to keep the dead stay put. So even souls that were benign in life, in the folk imagination, take on a certain terror in death. You know, just like in the ancient Egyptian or the ancient Greece times, right? There was a real fear of death. You know, better a beggar in hell than, you know, that whole story. So this stone barrier on the grave was thought to prevent a kind of haunting. And it really formed this important part of Jewish folklore. There's many really great around the campfire stories around that kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, if you look in the Old Testament, you can see that an altar was often just a pile of stones. And I don't know if Patrick talked about this, but there is this connection between the altar and the grave. So I mean, the story of Abraham, right? He takes his son to be sacrificed on this stone. And in the Jewish tradition, it's actually called the foundation stone of the world, this place where this sacrifice could have been. So, interesting that the official grieving lasts for 7 days. It's called Shiva. You're sitting Shiva. And that's just Hebrew for seven. And during this time, folks come, they visit the home. You know, you cover up the mirrors. And people, they wear on their arms that black ribbon. That's a symbol. Men don't shave. Women don't wear makeup. Couples refrain from intimacy. So this is really this idea of breaking daily routine, right? Which symbolizes this disruption that death has brought to their lives and demonstrates grief through self-sacrifice. So, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. There's so many traditions and stories it's wonderful to explore all of them. And I'm hoping that some of you out there have some things that your families have done or something that you've practiced in your tradition. And maybe we can go into breakout groups and talk about that for a few minutes, what your tradition is. And if you don't have a tradition, maybe there's a few things you've heard today that maybe might be something, or the water ceremony that happened the other day that you might want to incorporate into your create a new tradition for. So before we do that, is there any comments or questions, or should we just go right into the breakouts?
I'm ready for either. If someone wants to raise their hand or unmute and share something, otherwise we can go into the breakout room.
It's we like to call them the karmic groups, because you never know who you're going to end up with. And you remember, everything is confidential, and you can be encouraged to share contact information to continue your connection after the seminar. So, okay, Lisa, send us away.
I will do that. I will unmute everyone and send you into your rooms. Welcome back.
Hello, I was too quick. I just left the room.
Oh.
Interesting.
Was it good for you?
Yes, it was very nice.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, I'm so sorry, I just left the room. That wasn't my intention. I just clicked the button and zack, I was gone. So I'm sorry.
Sure, it was fine.
Yeah, no, these were my colleagues in the room, so they followed me.
So you came back. Very good.
But you were asking me something. I don't know what's your name on the bottom here. You with the red curly hair. You
oh,
just
yeah.
asked your question and was leaving.
No, I was just being appreciative of
okay.
you shared.
Hello.
Welcome back, everyone.
Hello.
Thank you.
It wasn't long enough.
I know. It never is.
All right. I'm going to mute everyone, and then I'll unmute you, Hazel, and you can get from there. There you are, Hazel.
Thanks. Great. So did anyone want to share from their groups? Did some wonderful things come up or anything that you feel that would be beneficial to all of us if we heard from you?
And it would be great if you want to use the raise hand option, which is on your participants panel. You can click on yourself and raise hand, and then I can unmute you. Or you can wave, and I can try to find you and or enter in the chat. Who would like to share something? Michelle, let me find you. There you go, Michelle.
Well, I've been telling everyone about borage when I've been in my breakout groups, that borage, the herb of joy and courage. And it's quite delicious and it tastes kind of like cucumber. And it's
talking about the borage flower. It's a flower,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
You can make tea with the leaves too. It's ruled by the planet Jupiter, the planet of benevolence.
And it's a beautiful flower too. We used to have some in our garden. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Who else would might like to, you can again, wave your hand or enter. I see Linda loved her group. Want to share anything about that, Linda?
Am I unmuted? I don't know if I got unmuted.
Linda's unmuted.
I think there's so much deep sharing that goes on in these groups. So I'm just so grateful for like what the people shared in my group and just the full presence of everyone. So it's just so rich and so I feel a lot of gratitude for my group.
Great.
Thanks. And they had some pretty deep stuff, like they've had where they've practiced and participated in rituals for their lifetimes, basically, around death and dying. And so it just seemed like a really nice, natural process that they fully engage in. And so it was nice to hear that.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Anyone else just going to wave your hand for a few minutes or? And I can click on you. Hazel, I think it's all yours.
Great. Well, I think we're all ripe to create our own new traditions. That's what I feel. I think we're ready now. We're the ones on the forefront of gathering this new kind of thinking and saying, okay, I'm going to consciously move into this death process. And we know that consciousness of our death informs our life, that life is a school and death is part of life. So sometimes it's really important to just let something die, you know, something that no longer serves in our lives in order to open a space for the birth of something new, right? So death can be something that we experience while we're alive, right? We can open the space by, you know, saying, hey, boy, I don't like that job. I need a new job, or this relationship, thank you, I have to move on. You know, it's a chance to break out of old patterns. And, you know, this helps us if we're stuck in a rut, then how we're supposed to really come into our true selves. And so, yeah, I mean, we can see that the Lenten season, that's a perfect time to practice, you know, actively this sacrifice where we give something up, which allows then for our rebirth. And this kind of a thing, when we do it consciously, it is a death done in conscious free will. So that really, I think, is the point here, that when we stand here at the Sacred Gateway, we want to make it a conscious opening of the gate. And again, I always love to go back to the circle of the year, because we are so blessed to have the lunar and the solar cycles and all of the seasonal milestones, this waxing and waning, this ascending, descending. And we did that with Eurythmy, contraction, expansion, right? This really sets the rhythm for the in-breath and the out-breath of life. We have to consciously live into these rhythms. And of course, you know, any time of year is a good time to confront our personal and cultural attitudes toward death, to consciously part the veil between the worlds, to reach out to our ancestors that have come before us and the descendants that will follow. So, yeah, this is something that I'm so glad that Patrick brought that up today, because I feel like we don't always talk about this part of the swinging door of the gateway, right? What about creating festivals for the unborn? You know, how can we welcome these souls that are waiting to cross the rainbow bridge into a new incarnation? You know, I've always united the honoring of the unborn with the so-called dead in my All Souls festivals. Since for me, this, again, it's the womb and the tomb, you know, both portals to the spiritual world. It's the same threshold seen from different angles, right? That image of the swinging door, I think, really works for me. So I've often worked with couples who want to start a family, you know, and a lot of times, trees on the family, the family tree grows, and we're not conscious of it. But to actually make a conscious intention to start a family, that's a really powerful thing, you know. And so, doing these kinds of ceremonies and such with a couple that wants to start a family, we can co-create. We can make a focused meditation that involves communicating with the ancestors who want to help from the other side, right? They're part of this lineage. And you can use social artistry. You know, I love making these slides. That's my way of making art. You know, by making art, we are also communicating with those on the other side who don't necessarily have words. So we can make a talisman. We could do collaging, visualization, things like that. And it's really, really important that the couple really open themselves up to the spiritual world and communicate what are, you know, that they are ready to receive, right? That means a lot to a being that's waiting to come through, that everything is ready and waiting for them. And again, it's really important to set up a consistent rhythm, perhaps aligning with the lunar cycle to build up the etheric forces. That always helps people conceive. And just really as many ways as there are to work with the so-called dead, the unborn, wait for our interaction. So this, I just wanted to touch in on this other point of concentration for me has been around this idea of preparing, you know, to receive those from the other side that are wanting to be born, points up what Steiner said about how those working with him 100 years ago now would return after a very short time in the spiritual world. He said around 80 years. That's I've been living with this for a really long time, and it's just interesting to think about. I mean, he gives usually, you know, the usual pattern is we would spend 1,000 years, earth years that we're thinking about in the spiritual world, working through everything and gathering the forces we need to come back where times have changed so much that we would have new experiences. But he said that those that were working with him would spend a very short time, 80 years is what he said, and then come back. And I believe it's because he wanted them to come back during this Michaelic age, that there was some work to do with Anthroposophy still. So to me, I feel like it was part of what's been living in this inspiration behind my dedication to the Elderberry's threefold initiative that we've been working to give birth to here in Chicago, which since our last Michaelmas festival, we've linked up with the Biodynamic Farmers. So we're really serious about creating circles for a renewal of culture. So this biodynamic outpost where art and economics and science and education can come together. Because it's really important that we confirm that we those of us here on Earth, we have a responsibility as anthroposophers to create the fertile foundations for the unborn to come into. You know, this it relates directly to the daughter movements, right? Waldorf education, that's a great foundation. Biodynamics, you know, Steiner talks about how if people don't eat food that has the cosmic influences, then they are not able to achieve their highest destiny. So there are many, many things that we can do as human beings on Earth here to prepare the ground for these souls to come through. And I think that's something that we need to really think about. You know, what is the legacy that we want to leave, the seven generations down the line?
Hazel, there's a question that Timothy Kennedy had, which I think fits with what you were just talking about. And it's just, can you say anything about working with those who have been conceived but are never born?
Well, I believe that Steiner speaks a lot about how people that are, I'm sorry, I'm going through the slides here, which is not what I want to do. Just like those who are born and then leave early, that I believe that there is some sort of a karmic connection that happens, and that they're fulfilling some sort of karmic knot. They're untying some sort of knot, or they're sacrificing their etheric forces to that individual. Their unused etheric forces can then be employed by the people, not just the couple, but for all, it can go into the etheric body of the earth and be used for those that need it. So to me, I feel like that there's a lot of interesting karmic things that we can't always know the reasons behind these things. And we don't necessarily want to put a judgment on it, but to know that there's some sort of karma being worked out there, and that it could be actually something that they signed up for, to touch in just a bit, and then to withdraw and take some energy back to the spiritual world. So it's a speculation. What do you think?
I'm just going to proffer for a moment that I think that's very powerful. And I guess the next question came for me about remembering for those conditions, to go ahead and follow whatever ritual you have for that crossing process, to do it fully, even though perhaps the soul did not manifest in full, but to deliver the full respect for that process.
That's beautiful. That makes sense. Timothy, did you have any thoughts on that, on your own question?
Sure, but yeah, of course. The question was more specifically about working with those souls. The reason and the nature for their extremely brief incarnation is a whole nother topic. But for me, it's something that I did really actively start to recognize in myself and in those around me who had experienced this relationship. And it does seem to really be a very specifically angelic, barely earthly support that I think also needs support. And so ways of working with those barely incarnated souls that I do feel do stay around the earth for what would be otherwise be a full lifetime, just not incarnated, and how that biography plays out in different ways, and how to support that biography in meeting its destiny.
Right. So how do we create awareness and consciousness, and then, you know, put that into our will, and that's what creating a ceremony is all about. But I think a lot of times too, just having an intention, just having a thought, just saying a prayer, just, you know, those kinds of things go a long way. You know, we don't necessarily always have to, you know, build a shrine, but that's okay too. Many different ways to express and acknowledge.
I'm Nicholas also with a question. So you're unmuted. You are now unmuted.
Well, it's a response. I believe that, that Rudolf Steiner speaks that, you know, those that die very young, and maybe even in this case, come back very quickly. And the turnover could be quite quickly for those who are, you know, who die before birth. And he also says there, and I don't remember the resource for these, this somebody else might, that the grieving, or the way that we work with souls that die when they're very young, is quite different than those that die at middle age, or those that die, you know, at their elder years. And I don't remember it well enough to quote it, but with the young, of course, we're not dealing with their karmalokas so much because they don't have much. We're dealing more with a generational situation. But that is very, very vague.
But a good point. Thank you. Yeah. Just think of all the gifts that we're receiving from I loved that image that Timothy said, that they're almost angelic beings. That's beautiful. You know, maybe they're trying to teach us how to become our future selves as angelic beings.
Can you just talk a moment for some who not really familiar with what Kamaloka is?
Well, it's a Hindu or Hindu term, which we could, in Western terminology, could be termed purgatory. It's sort of that in-between time as this the human being expands, as we do, becoming a spiritual being again. We expand up to the moon, which is the first sphere that we'll hit in the journey through the planetary spheres. And in that time is when we're really experiencing, you know, first we have that sort of life review, and then we really see all of the times that we interacted with somebody, and we see from their point of view what we did to them, whether it was a beautiful thing or a not so beautiful thing. We don't just see ourselves doing it. We feel what they felt as it was being done to them. And so this creates within our spirit and soul a need to change, or a need to say, oh, that was a good thing that I did, and I want to explore doing that more in my next lifetime. So this term kama loka, or purgatory, is when we really experience, and Steiner talks about it as experiencing heat and coldness. You know, it's hard to put these things into earthly terms, but so it can be a painful thing, even though we don't have a body to feel pain. But when we do feel pain, it's like, oh yeah, boy, I touched that stove and I don't want to do that again because I got burnt, right? It's an impetus for change. So that's the kama loka is a school. It's a school where we learn, you know, how to be better. That's the way I think of it. So yeah, I mean, I think besides thinking about these other beings that, you know, going through that swinging door, it's important as we're here on Earth to really strive to understand our own prenatal commitments, right? We were all in the spiritual world doing that work in Kama Loka, doing that work through each one of the planetary spheres, unraveling our karmic knots, meeting those that we have connections with, and coming back to meet again. So we make certain agreements. We make a little plan, a little blueprint, right? In the dome of our head there, we see all the outline of the planets that we came into and into birth. And it's all there, like a little map. But we go about our lives and we get up and we drink our coffee and we drive in our car or whatever, and we forget that we're these spiritual beings that made these plans, right? So sometimes it's good, man. Maybe this is part of why we're, you know, getting together, is to just stop and say, okay, what were my commitments? What did I sign up for? You know, echoing the words of the guardian of the threshold, to know thyself. That's what this slide represents. You know, so that we can make manifest the destiny that we signed up for, remembering and implementing the blueprint that we created with the highest spiritual beings before we came into this life. So I think we have work to do here, you know, on ourselves. And then once we know who we are, then we can contribute to the whole. And that's an important aspect of our work. So I thought maybe this might be another good time to have a little more eurythmia. What do you think, Raven? Would you like to do it now, or do you want to wait till the end?
Why don't we do just a little bit right now, and then okay. At the end I would love to have time to do hallelujah with everyone.
Perfect.
And what I wanted to do now, I'm not sure you can see me, but there we go, is just a very simple soul exercise. It's called Love A. And the movement of it is simply reaching out as if you could embrace the whole wide world with love. And while you're there, if you can really create for yourself a feeling of love, you might actually feel your heart chakra start to open and move. And then take all of that love and bring it to yourself. And then again, you can have the feeling, I'm in love with the whole wide world. And that makes me strong. Love. A. I'm just going to do it two more times. If you can really try not to pour yourself into the screen now that you know it's simple, but to really be with yourself and feel your heart forces flowing out.
And then when they come, when you come back in, this is a pretty strong A, not that you would hurt yourself in it, but that you really feel strength. I'm just going to say love A, so you don't need to look at me. You can just really stay with yourself. Love. A. Love. A. And rest.
So I are we supposed to end like really soon? Did we go through everything?
Are we done?
No, we have more, but I mean, what time are we supposed to end? I'm losing my track of time here.
I don't remember.
A couple minutes. All right, whatever. I'll just go on.
They're almost done.
Yeah. So I really just, in conclusion, I'll just really just say that I really feel like we are magical beings and we can transcend all the dimensions. We can open all the sacred gateways, the gateway inside of ourselves, the gateway out there to the spiritual worlds. It's really all one. It's really all one. We don't have to see it as separate. There's many, many magical clues waiting to be revealed through the essence of the ancient mysteries, from our own heritage, you know, without getting caught up in the old nationalism, as well as investigating other cultures that have a strong attraction. You know, I remember growing up and just was like, oh, I'm really fascinated by the ancient Egyptian culture. And I dug right into all of that stuff and loved to put the eye makeup on and do all of that, you know, and I think, well, maybe I had some sort of connection with that. So if you feel that, investigate it, look into it. You know, I have a strong connection to the Celtic side of the blood in from my mother's side, and I've looked into that. That's really important to me. But I don't want to get caught up in the blood. I want to reinvigorate myself and really see that really we are all part of one world in a time that calls for us to stand in social unity, to work with each other and those across the threshold to create a fertile ground for those wanting to cross the rainbow bridge, fostering our practice of anthroposophy, a world reality that allows us to achieve our highest human destiny and helps us to transform the earth into a sacred planet, a new sun, where love and freedom hold sway in every head, hand, and heart. And to feel that new sun being born within ourselves every day. Let the sun rise within ourselves every day. So, yeah, I think that's all I had. And I think that's our time, huh?
Well, yes. Did you want to close with, did you have a Eurythmy closing?
Yeah, let's close with that hallelujah.
Okay.
Thank you, my friends. Thank you, Raven. That was beautiful.
Thank you, everyone. Well, the next event will begin at 15:45, just for your context.
Perfect. Continue the work, people. We'll see you there. Thank you so much.
Bless you, everyone. Thank you, Hazel.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Hazel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hazel.
Thank you. Thank you. Enjoy being and be well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Be safe. Be well.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Raven.
And thank you, Raven.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Lisa. Bless you.
Bless you.